Everyone alive knows about luck. The lucky break that for whatever reason of being in the right place at the right time, you get a break, sometimes in a way you did not deserve. Or equally, the unlucky break that again you did not deserve. We look to society to redress these lucky rights and unlucky wrongs. Society should do the same with those born or whose genes or an accident deliver a physical or an intellectual impairment. But it's not as effective as it could and should be. Even the way society frames the idea of impairment is crucial, as I will explore today with two guests who work tirelessly to make Britain a more accessible and inclusive place for disabled people. It's not just about making our public transport system or our public buildings less of a physical barrier to those experiencing whatever impairment or disability, important as those are. It's about recasting the unintentionally oppressive way we discuss the very concept. The social model of disability, that's a social science prism through which to look at this issue, aims to recast the way we conceive of disability and so enfranchise everyone. Dr. Shani Danda may be our first guest on the We Society podcast, who's also been featured in Vogue magazine for her work. An entrepreneur and disability activist, she's at the start of her social science career, but already can boast of a string of practical achievements, voted the most influential disabled person in the UK last year. Professor Anna Lawson is a professor of law at the University of Leeds and one of the most notable researchers in the field. Throughout her academic career, she has worked with disabled people and researchers to tackle the exclusion that disabled people face across the globe. She's acted as an expert advisor within Parliament, the Council of Europe, and the European Union. Anna, you join us from Leeds, and Shani from the slightly warmer climate of Dubai. Welcome to you both. Anna, can I start with you? When we invited you onto the We Society podcast, what was your, describe that kind of idiosyncratically named podcast, what was your first thought?
First of all, thank you so much for that invitation. My first thought was, my goodness, that's a huge honour. And I'm afraid my imposter syndrome slightly crept in as a disabled woman. And then I thought, actually, the we is totally what my work is all about. And making the claim for disabled people to be part of that we is what I've really been striving to do for the last few decades. So I love the phrase, the we society. And I think it was also particularly exciting to be invited to be part of this podcast with Shani, because that makes it even more of a we.
Shani, your reaction when we invited you on this podcast?
Oh, thank you. Really similar to Anna, I saw her name and I was like, yeah, I definitely want to be part of this. I've followed Anna's work for a really long time. You know, she's doing some incredible work, and it's a huge honour to be on this podcast today. I think we're going to have a great conversation.
Well, let's get it started. And what we're going to do is Anna, I'll give you a couple of minutes, and then Shani can just come in, or vice versa. But let's just kick off with a kind of top-down view. I mean, how would you rate the UK as a place to live for disabled people? Anna?
I think it's a really difficult question, this one, because it's not a simple, straightforward one. There's lots of aspects of living in the UK that are great. I'm a disabled person and I wouldn't want to live anywhere else. But that said, there are lots of ways in which it could be better and in which it needs to be better. There are reports from the ONS, from the Equality and Human Rights Commission, which really highlight the ongoing problems. You know, that there's stark statistical data around the disability gaps in education, in employment and poverty. The fact that I think over half of the people who live in poverty in the UK are either disabled or live with a disabled person is really quite shocking.
That is shocking, isn't it? That is shocking.
Yeah. Yes, it is shocking. And progress hasn't been linear. We're not, you know, making steady progress towards things getting better. In some ways, things have got worse over the past few years.
Is that austerity? What's cultural attitudes when you say things have got a bit worse? Is that COVID? I mean, what's the driver of that?
Yes, austerity and COVID. I think both of those two have been important factors. So austerity has led to, as I think most people will be aware, significant cuts in welfare that have impacted disabled people particularly badly. So there was a UN examination of the UK in 2016 where the chair of the committee described the impact of these austerity measures on disabled people as a human catastrophe. That's something I think that has prompted government action. You know, it's prompted global disability summits and the UK lead in those. But the fact remains that a lot of disabled people in the UK are still battling against immense poverty and immense barriers, and we mustn't forget that.
Well, that's quite a shock. We're going to try and open that up in this podcast this today. Shani, the same. What's your view? And are we in a sense of the scale of this? I mean, numbers. I mean, people born, people develop issues, people kind of have unexpected accidents. I mean, are we? I mean, numbers. It's a number that runs into some millions, isn't it?
Definitely. So the government figures currently say there's around 16 million disabled people, and that equates to about 24% of the population, which is almost one in four. But the stat that really surprised me when I started out on my disability advocacy journey was that 83% of disabled people acquired their condition. I'm someone, I was born with my condition. And then that led me to think, well, if the majority of disabled people acquire their health condition or impairment throughout their life, then why as a society are we not designing for our future selves? It just doesn't make sense to me. And, you know, pre-pandemic, I used to say that there was never a better time to be a disabled person. And when I used to say that, people used to look at me in a really quizzical way as if, you know, why would you ever say that there was ever a good time to be a disabled person? But as Anna has pointed out, over the last couple of years, our rights have been further deteriorated. You know, we're living in a really hostile environment right now in the UK. However, it's still a good place to live if you are a disabled person in comparison to many other countries in the world. But there are other countries that I visit and I feel I experience much less disability in comparison to when I am in the UK. So it swings and roundabouts, really.
Two things arise from what you just said. One, the kind of hostile environment, which has got more hostile in the UK. And when you visit other countries, it's less hostile or even friendly. I mean, where's got it right and why has it got worse in the UK? What is the nature of that hostility? I mean, is it people's attitudes or just, you know, just so much of the physical structures around us are impairment unfriendly?
Yeah, and that's it's a great question. And I think it's important for us to understand that we as people, our human nature is to be quite exclusive, not inclusive or accessible, because when we make decisions, we only really approach it from the knowledge that we have and the biases that we have. How often do we stop and think, you know, have I thought about everybody or am I disrupting my bias on this issue? And I wouldn't say that there's a perfect place in the world to be disabled. There's no such thing as perfect. But I know that when I'm in America, for example, people largely act out of compliance because they don't want to be sued for disability discrimination. And in America, it's much easier to access that process and that system. So I wish I could sit here and say, oh, I think it's because, you know, they really value and appreciate disabled people and our custom. And I'm sure lots of places do and companies do. But I do know that also it is largely out of fear and not wanting to get it wrong, but also acting out of compliance. You know, I'm here in Dubai. The UAE was formed just over 50 years ago. It's for me as a tourist here, it's a great place to be. It's really accessible. And in fact, they call disabled people of determination, which I think's quite progressive considering, you know, that they're only 50 years on this journey.
Well, yeah, you are both determined people, I can tell you. Anna, as you hear Sharni speak, what's your... Want to build on that? I mean, take it, run with the ball a bit?
Yes, thank you. I loved what Sharni said about acting out of compliance in the US and the fact that law is actually making a difference there.
Yeah.
We have some great laws in the UK. We have the Equality Act, which on paper is really progressive and very strong, but its impact is much weaker than it should be because access to justice is so bad here. It's so difficult to bring cases. It's so expensive to bring cases. A lot of the burden of bringing cases falls on disabled people themselves.
Didn't the legal aid so-called reforms in the early years of the Conservative government, back 2012-2013,
yes,
stripping access to legal aid really disproportionately hit those with impairments?
I think they hit people wanting to bring discrimination claims generally. But the impact on disabled people, I think, is particularly profound because a lot of the types of cases that we might want to bring concern accessibility of public services. And those ones, you know, they're not ones where you don't bring them if you stand to lose a lot of money from bringing that case because you try and find an alternative way or you just don't go out as much. If it's an employment issue or somewhere where you stand to gain financially if the case succeeds, then there's more of an incentive to battle on through. But certainly a lot of the accessibility-related measures, they depend on individuals coming forward and taking action, which is really the wrong emphasis anyway. It should be, there should be much more emphasis on collective strategies for monitoring and enforcing the accessibility of those things that make the world go around for us all, rather than relying on an individual to come forward and take the financial risk. But you're absolutely right, the legal aid cuts, the legal aid changes made it much more difficult for equality generally.
Now, both of you are champions of the this social model of disability. Could I just spell it out? Because I do think it's, you know, I mean, it's a social science podcast after all, and it's very much a kind of, as I said in the introduction, a social science kind of prism through which to look at the world. I mean, do you want to describe it and just get, why you yourself find it enfranchising?
So I think this, it's a wonderful idea. I discovered it. I wish I discovered it much earlier in my life than I did. I discovered it in the late 1990s. And it's a very simple idea that comes actually from disabled people's organisations, but it really they were social scientists who were living in residential institutions and not employed, but they were independent social scientists in effect and did a lot of thinking about how society was working and the exclusion they were experiencing because the world was so inaccessible to them. So the idea is very simply that instead of thinking of the idea of disability as a problem that lies within the individual with the impairments, to separate out the idea of disability and think of it as something that's socially created. So it's akin to oppression in a sense. It's linked to external factors and it's something that exists on top of our impairment. And obviously there's a very close connection between the way we experience the exclusion that results from the interaction of our impairments with external, socially created factors. But it's very liberating, it's very empowering, because the idea is through the social model, it focuses our attention on the external world. And that could be attitudes, it could be physical environments, it could be information, communication, it could be practices of social care, practices of education. All these externally, socially created factors and organisations and systems, how they can be changed so that we become less disabled, so they become less disabling.
I think it's a really, if there's one takeaway from today's podcast, I think it's that actually those of us who don't suffer from an impairment at the moment, but actually it might strike, I'm very struck by what Sharni said at the beginning, are unintentionally most of us, at least unintentionally, don't recognise the nature of that oppression, and actually changing our language, understanding better how to frame our relationship with those who suffer from a disability, or experience a disability, I should say, is a most important thing. I mean, we need to be enablers of that enfranchisement. Shall we, can I turn to you? I mean, the social model of disability, I mean, would you echo Anna's view? I mean, or build on it?
Absolutely. So I discovered the social model of disability by accident when I was at university, and it changed my life. So I was in my early 20s at this point. And, you know, I really live at the intersection. I'm a South Asian disabled woman. And in my community, the Sikh Punjabi community, disability faces an even further sense of stigma due to lots of different reasons. And so when I discovered the social model of disability, it suddenly lifted this big weight off my shoulders that I didn't even know was there, because I had always been given this narrative that, oh, you must have done something bad in your past life. That's why you were born with your condition.
It's a disgrace, that.
It is.
It's a kind of ridiculous way of looking at it.
Yeah. And it never made sense to me. It made me feel guilty over I don't know what. It's just awful framing. So when I discovered the social model, it made so much sense to me. But also, it gave me a lot of confidence, and it helped me to process it, you know, living with my condition, my body image, my self-worth. And then since then, the cogs in my head just sort of said, well, this makes so much sense to me. If only we could get this message out there to more people. And there's some research by Even Break, which is a job site for disabled people. And they found that at least 75% of disabled people do not know about the social model of disability. And when I started to think about this, it kind of makes sense, because when you live with a condition or an impairment, you are medicalised. And of course, we want and need that access to healthcare. You know, I wouldn't have the quality of life that I have without it. But not one medical professional ever said to me, your condition doesn't disable you. It's society and the way in which, you know, things are designed or how people think. And, you know, if someone had said that one sentence to me as a child, I feel like my whole life would have been different. I would have had so much, you know, self-confidence, self-worth from a much younger age. I feel like I would have been able to assert myself in a more articulate way. So for me, that through the work that I do with lots of different businesses and brands as a consultant, that's exactly what I teach them. I teach them that we disable one another, but it doesn't have to be this way. We can actually change our practice and be more inclusive, because accessibility benefits absolutely everybody.
Just before I think at this stage, we probably should let listeners know what is the nature of your impairment, actually.
Yeah, so I was born with a rare genetic condition. It's more commonly known as brittle bone disease. So it means that my bones break without any trauma. I don't have to have an accident or an injury. And I also have a short stature as a result. So I'm about the height of a four-year-old. And you know, there isn't a cure for my condition. And whether I want one or not, that's a whole separate issue. But I think that's why the social model is so important, because it helps us to frame barriers in a way where we can find solutions. And I think that's why people don't know how to help disabled people, because they only see it as a health condition or a health problem. But my condition doesn't disable me. It's barriers and bias.
And you certainly are a determined person. I can, Anna.
Yes. So maybe I'll start off by, so I'm blind. I'm completely blind, and I started losing my sight when I was seven. So it's a genetic condition, but it's a recessive gene. So it wasn't identified, because my parents have perfect sight. Yes, I have a whole story about how it was identified, which was traumatic, because the optician thought I was making it up to get attention to begin with. they told the school teacher not to let me sit near the blackboard, or not to be sympathetic if I said I couldn't read something. So Yes, so that's my impairment, and like Shani, I should have said when I discovered the social model, it was through reading social science literature actually, and I just had to keep running downstairs because I was so excited about it, telling everyone, because I felt in going through that process of losing my sight and having to ask for, you know, things to be done differently, to ask for assistance. I was internalising that general attitude of ableism, I suppose, and feeling like I was being a burden on people for asking for things, or in order to have a stake in education or something, having to get things taped, or, you know, people were wonderful, but it was hard work. It was extra work for people to make things accessible for me, and I really felt that. And then the social model, really, I think like Shani, if I'd known about it earlier, it would have really helped me to feel more confident about asking for things. And however generous people were with their time and support, I felt like I was a burden, and it would have helped me deal with that much better.
Before we continue, we want to tell you about a show from our friends over at The Conversation that we'd love listening to. In The Conversation Weekly, academic experts talk to host Gemma Ware about the research they're doing to make sense of the world and the big questions that they're still trying to answer. You'll get a bit of everything, from how women influencers are changing the face of the far right, to the science of interoception, our sixth sense, to how a method of opinion polling used in Northern Ireland could help reach a peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinians. What's so powerful is that they talk directly to researchers who spend their whole lives studying a topic, and each episode always leaves us feeling a lot smarter. New episodes come out every Thursday. Find it by searching for The Conversation Weekly wherever you get your podcasts. I want to discuss kind of interventions, how we can deploy the law. But before we do that, Shani, just to come back to you, I mean, there must be some kind of, at the core of you, some kind of spring that has made you into the person you are. Am I wrong? I mean, how do you kind of explain how you've got to where you've got to?
A lot of people ask me this, and I'm never quite sure how to answer this, because it was never my plan. I never planned that I'd be doing any of what I'm doing, and it's a huge honour as well to do this. But I feel like it's mainly come out of having to survive. So I went to a special needs primary school. I was segregated from, you know, mainstream education. But then, as I mentioned, I'm a Sikh Punjabi woman, and on the weekends, me and my family would go down to London and go to protests about Sikh rights. So in the week I was being institutionalised, and on the weekends I was out fighting for rights. And I didn't get it at that age. And so I've learned a lot about activism from my family, from my culture, from my parents. And I feel like they've been a great example. And I think, you know, they've been a good example in the fact that if you've got a voice and you can and want to use it on behalf of others, then that's a good thing to do. But also, not only did I face lots of, you know, attitudinal barriers, physical barriers, there's lots of different cultural barriers as well, as I've touched upon, being a South Asian disabled woman. I really had to fight for my own rights within my own home, within my community. And I was really infantilized as a young person. And as Anna spoke so beautifully about the low perceptions that other people have of you are what really motivate you. So there's definitely been an element of that for me. But also, you know, I just thought, why does life have to be this hard? Why does anything I want to do have to be fought with so many barriers? And I wanted to be part of that change. And I wanted to help make society more accessible and inclusive. But I also didn't come into this work straight away. I was an event manager for 10 years. Absolutely loved it. And then I slowly started to find my voice in disability activism, and my journey really started from there.
Let's discuss in the kind of last part of this podcast. Let's get on to kind of what your activism has achieved, Shani, and what you want to achieve. And then I want to come back to Anna and ask her the same questions. So just what do you regard as, look back over the last kind of, say, 5 years, and milestones, and what have you got in your sights for the future?
Oh, great question. So earlier this month, I worked with high street retailer Primark, and they launched their very first adaptive clothing range. We live in a society where there are more clothes designed for dogs than disabled people. As someone who's the height of a four-year-old but has the body of a woman, I can never go into a shop and buy and wear clothes. I have to get everything tailored. So this, you know, although it's just one range at the moment and it's the first high street retailer, this work is so overdue. And just the fact that I've been able to partner with them as an accessibility specialist, it's amazing. I feel like I could just quit now if I wanted to. but no, it's things like that. It's all the things I wish existed when I was younger, when I was growing up, and now it exists. It's that. It's an amazing feeling. But yeah, it's an honour to work with some of the world's biggest brands and businesses to help them put inclusion at the heart of what they do. And for me, I feel like that's a success in itself.
It certainly is. And looking ahead, what are your targets?
Oh, I don't know. I just kind of go with the flow, you know.
Okay. Well, I'll give you a chance. You'll give you a chance to reflect on that. Anna, now you are arguably, the most prominent academic lawyer preoccupying themselves with kind of impairment and disability issues in the country and arguably in Europe. As you look back, are there things that you're particularly proud of? Are there things that you've got, are there targets you have in mind?
Yes. You know, you don't plan it. You put your energy into it and do what you can when there's an opportunity. And that's what's motivated my academic career. So it's, you know, it's been such a joy to work on an issue which I feel so passionately about at a personal level, not just for myself, but for, you know, as a social cause and as something that there is so much scope for law to engage with better in society and influence society in ways to make it work better than it does. So I think I've been very opportunist. I haven't followed a particular plan like Shani. And I think universities, now that the REF has introduced the impact case studies, I'm delighted that impact-related work has got the recognition that it deserves. Because before that, I think people like me who were driven by impact, it was rather difficult because it was taking attention away from the more theoretical work that we could have been doing. So it's wonderful to have that embedded in the REF system. That's a real positive development.
For non-academics, the REF system is is it 5 or 6 or 7 years? I can never remember.
But it varies.
A system for appraising departments and sometimes individual academics for the quality of the research and the impact it has. It's a kind of regular exercise, isn't it?
That's right, it is, yeah. And I think that's helped me focus on, you know, what impact have I actually achieved? But it's never impact alone. It's always impact with other people. And particularly with disabled people's organisations, it's really crucial not just to work, you know, as a sole academic, but to work with organisations that are pushing for the same sorts of things, that have the same motivation, and indeed to learn from them, because that's where the social model comes from. That's where a lot of lived, you know, the knowledge about lived experience comes from.
But the range of things that you've been involved in is extraordinary. I mean, it's everything from kind of physical infrastructure and access to that, to widening the possibilities of getting legal redress in discrimination. I mean, it's a broad canvas, isn't it, you operate on across.
It is. I've had to be on my toes all the time because I'm constantly learning. And access to justice is a very common theme. It comes up everywhere. And the need to have, you know, more efficient, more effective mechanisms that don't rely on individuals having to go to court to enforce their rights. But I've loved picking up areas that have been, that don't get so much limelight. So although, you know, education and employment are areas I've worked on a bit, I've deliberately chosen areas which don't get so much attention, particularly in the legal domain. So at the moment, I've got a big project on inclusive public space, which is looking at pedestrian infrastructure, which is actually a massive issue because it's the in-between space. It's the bits that most people take for granted about, you know, your day-to-day life, how you get from one place to another. But if those don't work, which they often don't,
yeah,
and new developments often make it harder, ironically, then everything else tends to fall apart. It gets difficult to get to the doctor, to go and visit friends, to go to the cinema, let alone going to university or the place where you work.
Are universities getting better at this, do you think? And then I'm going to bring Charlie in.
From my perspective, I think universities, EDI has definitely gone up the agenda. EDI is so front and centre in a lot of university agendas.
Equality, diversity and inclusion, for those who don't
know. Which is great. That's where it should be. But universities are big organisations, very bureaucratic, and they're often not as nimble as they should be.
Yep.
And things are changing. You know, accessibility, disability inclusion is not a one-off event. It's something that needs constant engagement. As new things come in, there always needs to be thinking about how accessible, how inclusive that is. So I was very excited when online marking was introduced because I thought, fantastic. I've had to mark online for years before everybody else because that's the only way I can read the material. But then the online system, now it's come in, is inaccessible. So again, I'm on the outside. So a lot of things which you think, okay, that's fantastic. It should be the opportunity for more inclusion. We miss that opportunity because we're not insisting that accessibility is embedded from the beginning.
Shani, now you're keen on intersectionality, aren't you? Do you want to explain that concept and how it kind of impacts on your campaigning and your activism?
Intersectionality was coined by Professor Kimberly Crenshaw, and it's a theory that helps us to understand how we all have so many different characteristics and different identities. You know, each and every one of us, every human being is intersectional. We all have different characteristics, but it's how they all intersect and overlap and compound and form different types of oppression or privilege. And the real issue arises is when you're only sort of put into one box or one category. So, you know, I'm a South Asian disabled woman, but quite often people only ever put me in the disability box. Then that fails to acknowledge all of the different types of barriers or needs that I may have because of all my other identities. What's really interesting, especially from my time in event management, we're very good at asking one another what each other's dietary requirements are. But how often do we ask each other what our access requirements are? And, you know, as someone who's an international keynote speaker now, people are great at meeting my dietary requirements, but they haven't bothered to check whether I can get in the building.
Yeah, we're asked for our dietary requirements, but every time you go, you sit down to eat almost, and no one ever asks, can you get in or can you get out or can you get to the loo? You know, you're absolutely right, and this is the social model at work. I mean, society has to kind of own this. And each and every one of us, when we kind of relate to one another, I'm almost on the point of saying this, but maybe it's a slightly extravagant point to make, but I think everyone's nursing some kind of weakness, which may not be a physical intellectual impairment, but certainly a weakness. And actually respectful of that, you know, opens the door, I think, to the kind of the social model of disability. And as you've been both talking, I've been reflecting on my own kind of attitudes and life experience and thinking, you know, from now on, I'm going to be much more alert to this than I was before. We've got to wrap this up, I think. We're coming near the end of our time. Anna, I'm going to make you kind of supreme being for a week. Yeah. And you have an opportunity to do at least one, and I'm going to give you a second or a third thing that you really want to happen. And you have, in your new role, the capacity to make that happen. What would it be?
Gosh. one thing would be to have a system. This sounds maybe a bit remote, but I think it's so important to have a system where governments actually engage in... It's a bit like the process that the European Union has already, but we're outside of now, around, you know, having shared goals and objectives around what we want to achieve around disability. And to some extent, we have that with the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. But much more of a system, facilitated system, for governments to come together and think, OK, how are we going to get there? What progress have we made? What can we learn from what other countries are doing? No country has got it all right, but we can all learn things from each other. So just reflecting really actively on what we can learn about what's working well elsewhere. And research to some extent does that, comparative research. But I think if governments were more engaged in that and there was much more political commitment to that shared interactive comparative reflection and harnessing it then in strategies to get where we need to be, we would be a lot further on.
Is there a country, Switzerland, and Canada, I don't know, I mean, well, the Nordic countries, I mean, there's some countries which seem to be kind of, tend to be more progressive on these issues than others. Is there one that you'd point to and say they're ahead of the field, we should...
No.
No,
there isn't. I think each one is, that there are strengths which many have, and the, you know, some countries have more strengths than many others do. But there will often be things that aren't working so well. And that's partly a reflection of how complex disability is, because it's not just one type of impairment. Shani and I have very different types of impairment. But there's also, you know, psychosocial disabilities, cognitive disabilities. And often, you know, strength in one area doesn't equate with, you know, strong policies in another. The key thing to all of it, I think, is effective ways of involving disabled people's organisations in that dialogue and listening. So I think better listening to disabled people and to what's working elsewhere is the critical thing.
Shani, you're going supreme commander for a period of a few days, and you can pull off one or two dearly held objectives. What would they be?
I really love what Anna said, and I'd like to build on that. And I would love for everybody to understand what the social model of disability is. That would be a huge achievement. I would also love for people to understand that disability isn't a monolith, and one person doesn't know all the answers. And instead of just focusing on this just from a purely what can't you do, or what are your health conditions and impairments, let's completely reframe it to think, how can we make it society work for everybody? It doesn't matter how much ability you have or you don't have, it should work for everybody. And I would also like, you know, our governments and our parliamentarians to be more reflective and accessible. You know, the building itself where these decisions are made is not an accessible building.
It's a disaster, actually, isn't it? It's a disaster.
Yeah. And then we sit here and scratch our heads and think, well, why are there no disabled people who are MPs? You know, very few, I should say. So it's just redesigning it and putting accessibility at the heart of everything we do, because that's, you know, disability is the one diversity strand that runs across every other. It is the essence of diversity. So I think it's just more understanding, more awareness and more education for people to understand it's not that person's job over there. Literally every decision we make as individuals can raise or lower the barriers for participation in society.
Look, thank you both very much. We could go on for a lot longer, but I have to draw it to a close. We've reached our allotted span. I have found the last 45 minutes profoundly educational and at times very moving. Shani, you raised this notion of those with impairments should be seen as the determined ones. We have had the pleasure and actually, it's an overused word, but in a sense the honour of hearing two determined representatives of, I mean, the figure of 16 million people that Shami mentioned has also been going around my head, who one way or another have experienced an impairment which they've either born with or developed or by accident incurred. It's a lot of people. And actually, your joint insistence that the social model of disability should be known more widely, that it's the way that society kind of categorizes those with an impairment as disabled, that is itself disabling. And actually, to enter a new universe in which we talk about impairment, but part of the whole, is kind of enfranchising not only from those who are in that position, but for those of us who are not. I think you also kind of pointed the way to the role that social science can, if embedded more in government, could help equip government to come to do more across the piece to address the issues you've been discussing. So thank you very much for joining the We Society podcast. It's been a privilege to talk to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences, who can be found at acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton, the producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. Have any suggestions for guests, feedback for the programme? Email us on wesociety@acss.org.uk. And above all, thank you for listening.